I'd like to talk a bit about bodybuilding. That's not the bodybuilding like most people know it, but it's about the building of the body by the living cell, and also how architects build buildings which are suited for our bodies. I like puns because they always invite more ideas and expand the understanding of things. Like jokes, they enlarge our insight into what happens and what can happen. So in the idea of bodybuilding, quite literally I'm looking for a formulation of what happens within our body in the way our cells build our body, literally body building by the cells. I'm presenting this talk as part of a presentation series in August in Baden-Baden in Germany for the InterSymp Symposium. I've been going there for many years, and this time I'll be participating in the architectural setting as well. And for that gathering, I will be introducing the notion of tetrionics together with that of science of life. And it is very nice that in the combination of the two, it becomes clear that within our body, our cells use freedom of choice, which is the core of science of life, and they use the principles of tetrionics, which is the principle of creating of the universe, in combination. And that combination of the two is what we call the psychosomatic effect. It is the link between the psyche and the body and the soma. More literally, it is the psychology in the body and the physiology in the body, which at that level are the same. And it is my hope that architecture students can learn to understand that, and then can from their body learn what the principles are by which the cells put materials in such specific positions that they can optimize the cell communication, and as a result our body can function in the way it does by having all these clever capabilities. Very often architecture is still based on the notion that with a saw you get straight lines, and as a result many of the buildings are straight, even though the human in the interactions are using combinations of straight and circular, and as a result of that all kind of forms of interactional dynamics can take place. So it's my hope that architecture students, by seeing what the body can do, can come to a similar kind of functional, deep functional understanding of how information and matter connect up, or how purpose and forms connect up, as a result of which the activities which we as humans have in our environment can have the best kind of let's call it sounding board or resonators or wave guides, an environment to help us best do what we can do, choose to do. So in that talk I will be presenting four topics. First one is tetrionics, second one is the science of life, third one is the psychosomatic principle, and the fourth one is meta-design in architecture. And meta-design is a notion which has been created by John Wood, at that time of Goldsmith College, of the Department of Design Futures. And in that design department, there was a clear understanding that when designers create something, they also create consequences. For example, if they create a cheap car, then instead of just one of them riding on the road, there will be 50 million of them riding on the road, and suddenly the effects of the car are seen in a totally different perspective. You see the pollution, you see the exhaustion of resources, you see the kind of interaction that people have with their environment and the catastrophes and clashes that they have with that. You also see that humans use their body differently, and in that sense the design of a product is never finished when somebody puts a signature on a drawing board. Actually you need to see how, when it is built, it will require resources, and where can you get them from? Can you actually better recycle it from somewhere else? It will change the habits of people. Is that a benefit or not? The people who design weapons evidently do not take into account that somebody else might immediately use it on them. They might reconsider what they do. So it is that understanding of the sequence of consequences which makes meta design different from design, and by including those ideas in architecture, architects would no longer be limited to thinking about designing a building, but they will also be interior designers. How does that building work best for the people? Frank Lloyd Wright tried to do that, even designing up to the cutlery that the people could use. But the other way around, architects also need to be and become landscape architects. They need to take into account what kind of effect anything they create will have on the planet. But then architects also need to be aware that they are architects for the soul. A house is a shell for the soul, a skin for the soul. But does a housing situation limit the soul or enhance it? Why is that government provide the poor with stacks of high-rise housing without gardens, without vegetables, without culture? And why is it that the rich always seek to live in nature, next to water, next to glorious landscapes? There is a consideration on the way housing affects the mindset, the beliefs, and the lives, the quality of the life of people. So let me start with the first part of that story. I've already explained what Tetrionics is about. This is a creation by Calvin Abraham, who at some point realized that everything that he was using in radio communication engineering, had the basic radio diagram principles, could be imagined in the shape not of a rectangle but in the shape of a triangle. It's a story in itself how he came into that, and you can find that at tetrionics.scienceoflife.nl, where he eloquently and elaborately explains how he came up with the idea and how over 6 years the idea unfolded for him, how he needed to redesign it, reconceive it, re-understand it, reinterpret it, and as a result came out with a model in which the quantum of the universe can be depicted by an equilateral triangle. Those equilateral triangles have a plus side and a minus side, so in that sense the switch of a quantum is when you flip it over. And as it is electrical in nature, plus and minus electrical charge, when it moves it will automatically have a magnetic wake behind it, so electricity and magnetism is immediately connected, as is described in all of the equations of electromagnetism. But it also means that when you have these triangles you can link them up side by side and back to back, and you get whole planes of triangles, and that then is the basis of the quantum field. It is two-dimensional, it is an electromagnetic field, it is information in formation, and it is the foundation of all of the changes in the universe. One of the elements of the tetrionic quantum field is that it is possible for this field to curdle. When fields interact under very specific circumstances, the tetrions can not just flip over in the field, but they can start to rotate outside of the field. And that rotation is the equivalent of four quanta forming a tetrahedron. And a tetrahedron is the fundamental primordial form of matter. these four quanta together form this tetrahedral shape, just like the triangle is an inert shape, the tetrahedron is an inert shape. But in the case of the tetrahedron, it doesn't go anywhere. It will stay where it is, and you can either look at that as a tetrahedral shape, or you can also look at it as a vortex. They're equivalent representations of the same understanding. Once you know that, you can also understand that with these tetrions surrounded by quantum electromagnetic fields, there will be an interaction between the two. And tetrionics then describes that there is a linear current which can displace those tetrahedra, these tetrions, and there is also a circular current either around the tetrions or between clusters of tetrions. In the description of tetrionics, there are then a series of handbooks which show how out of these interplays between the linear current and the circular current of the quantum field, these tetrions can be clustered together in, on the one level, the subatomic elements, the subatomic particle zoo, as it is called. And in tetrionics, this is very neatly described and understood how logical, how simple, and how elegant that can be portrayed in the geometry of tetrionics. Out of that particle zoo, there are some particles which are typical, let's call it that, and those are the neutron and the proton. These are actually the same shape of elements in tetrionics, but they have a different charge distribution. So even though they have the same amount of tetrions within them, the surface charges of the tetrions are not distributed in the same way, as a result of which, for the neutron, the overall surface charge is balanced plus and minus, while for the proton, there is a residual plus charge on the surface. The negative charges are on the inside, in its way. Between the proton and the neutron, there is a plane in which they have exactly the opposite charges, and that is where they then can connect, as they have this charge connection of plus and minus attracting each other, in what is called the strong force. In tetrionics, when the sides of a tetrion connect plus and minus, that's called the strong force. When the ribs of the tetrions connect, 2 plus on the one side, 2 minus on the other side, that's called the weak force. And when the tips of the tetrions, one 4 plus, the other 4 minus, when they connect, that's called the derived force. Tetrionics then has the whole further description of how people can work with this and how they can understand that, and it's a very gracious and elegant and beautiful way of seeing how that level of reality which we cannot see, cannot understand, can nevertheless be imagined and represented in this geometry. So at that point, I nicely direct the people to pick up tetrionics and to find out the riches and depth of all it has to offer. Once I got to know tetrionics, I realized how much it connected to what I had looked for. I had come from a different perspective. I was looking at phase changes in a field. So I wasn't really looking at structure, but I was looking at processes. And I was thinking not in terms of tetrahedra, but in terms of vortices. And with a bit of comparison, I realized that the tetrion and the vortex is actually quite the same. And I also realized that what I have been looking for in the science of life as the foundation of creation in living beings can't be seen to be the quantum in tetrionics. It can actually not be understood from the perspective of conventional science, for the simple reason that in conventional science there are a couple fundamental problems which cannot be easily resolved, such as when plus and minus particles attract, they should either explode or implode and explode if they are electrical, or they should stick together if they are magnetic, which means that in a universe where you have plus and minus charges, the end result will be either an explosion or an implosion and a solidification of the universe. That's not what you find. Also, if you look at the model of, say, the miniature galaxy of the atomic system, with a core and electrons orbiting, there is a difficulty in understanding why in this core plus particles, proton, would hang together, because like charges repel, so there would not be a possibility for them to hang together in that way. Also, if the electron orbits around that, there are too many speculatory items associated with that, for the simple reason that if an electron has to go from one orbit to the other, and as the model implies, a photon is able to do that, then in that model you would have a kind of billiard ball game, in which on the billiard table you have a cluster of nucleus of the atom in the middle of the table, and then circulating around that you have these electrons going at a light speed, and then you need to have a photon to collide with that electron. And if you imagine it to be two billiard balls, the electron to be a billiard ball and the photon to be a billiard ball, then while that electron is spinning around at light speed in a circular orbit, and this photon moves around but a linear orbit, it is as if with your billiard cue stick you try to shoot one ball against another ball moving around at light speed in a circle, and you have to hit it at the precise time at the precise spot with the exact spin that it can move from one orbit to the other and do nothing else. There is something very wrong with that model, even though de Broglie has explained that the electron orbits will be at the wavelength 1, 2, 3 and so on, which in a different way would simply mean that the electron does not exist in that manner, but the electron is actually a coincident wave, where the wave feeds back on itself and is stable. So you have wavelength 1, it is stable there because it superimposes on itself and repeats itself. Wavelength 2, where the same happens but one higher frequency. Wavelength 3, same, and so on. But at the wavelength 1.5 or 2 minus a half, those waves cancel out, and so there will be no structured presence in that region. So even if you allow for a shift of understanding by going away from the particle view of the electron into a wave model, then still there are too many difficulties of actually trying to grasp what's going on. Tetrionics resolves that. It has the proton, neutron, and within it an electron as the core of the atomic structure. It actually provides everything which physics has discovered. The measurements are the same. The organization is the same. The results are much more simple. So it's definitely the paradigm shift which people have been looking for. But now I want to come to the other aspect of that, because the quantum change is then the fundamental unit of change in the universe. But how come that in our body we have this quality called life, which you do not find in dead matter. In the science of life, the approach is very simple. If you look at a rock and you put it somewhere, you can come back 2,000 years later and you can still find the rock in place, as is seen in the Acropolis. You can even come back later, as you can see in the pyramids. The rock will still be there unless it has been taken away, as, for example, had the outer layer of the pyramids have been used to build a mosque at the other side of the river. Dead matter will not do anything by itself. Dead matter is inert, and in that sense, dead matter is exactly what tetrionics says about the tetrion. It's inert, will not do anything by itself. It needs the quantum field to do something. If you compare a rock to a living being, say you compare a rock and a cat, you put the rock somewhere, you can come back 2,000 years, and you put a cat somewhere, and most likely it will have moved very soon after. Because in living beings, there is a capacity to internally reorganize that matter, but not just that, it is possible for living beings to reorganize their position in their context by using information. That means that in living beings, information matters. The information will actually reposition the matter, and that is where then in living beings we need to understand why and how that is possible. Reconnect that to tetrionics and understand that the essence of tetrionics is that you can flip a quantum, and then that is also the core of understanding freedom of choice. It needs a slight change of interpretation though, because in tetrionics consciousness is not part of the picture. Human involvement is not part of the story. Tetrionics simply looks at the physics of the tetrionic field and how from the tetrionic field tetrions are formed, atoms are formed, molecules are formed, matter is formed. All of it is formed from the quantum field, and all this is formed by the quantum field, and in that sense the quantum field is God, as the religious used to call it. It is the invisible mover, it's the invisible creator, it's the invisible connector, and it is in fact the pattern which links everything with everything else in the universe. Now we need to understand that in living beings, whatever animal, plant or species it be, there is this possibility of internally resetting the boundary. And that is actually how in the science of life I came to the understanding of these fundamental principles of life and freedom of choice. I realized that in science everything that is described has that description because of the way the boundary is defined. But a boundary is no more than an interface. And if you look at a boundary of whatever it be in a more fundamental manner, if you stop looking at the structure but start looking at the process, then you can see that the boundary is a place where something reflects. I tend to say that you can see the ball bounce back from the wall, and as a result you know that there is a wall, even if the wall would be invisible. And even if the ball would be invisible, if you do something and something bounces back at you, you know that there will be a wall somewhere. If you look at what happens at that wall, without the wall the ball goes straight on, with the wall the ball bounces back. That going forward or bouncing back is called phase change. If the ball goes forward, there's no phase change. If the ball bounces back, there's a total phase reflection. And there's something very interesting in that, because in that sense you can understand that any boundary in any system is a wave change agent. at the moment that you can create a boundary, you will change how the waves around it will propagate or not. At the moment that you can maintain a boundary, you will determine that the field around it will have to now function in a different manner. Anytime that you can take away a boundary, you can then affect what happens in the field around it. So there is a fundamental principle of playing with boundaries, which George Spencer Brown has described in his book Laws of Form. He described it as logic. I prefer to look at it as a wave phenomenon. At the moment that you can create a distinction, as he calls it, create a boundary, if you create a point of phase change, and then by generating, operating, or destroying that phase change, destroying that boundary, you will determine what happens around it. And that is the core of what happens in living beings. They can generate, they can operate, and they can destroy boundaries. And we can see it in cells which divide. Suddenly there's not just more cells, but there are also more boundaries. There's not just more substance, but there's also much more filtering capacity, because every boundary is a filter. In that way, the science of life then explored the characteristic of the connection of all these boundaries, all these filters, and realized that more important than those boundaries is the capacity to generate, operate, and destroy boundaries. Generate, G, operate, O, destroy, D. It's a G-O-D principle, but the creation, the maintenance, and the destruction of a boundary is significant only if it does something in the larger environment. It needs to be integrated in that environment. That's why in the science of life this is called the I-God principle: integrate, generate, operate, destroy. And in that sense, the science of life then is all about the understanding of the creation and changing of boundaries, and that is precisely what cells do in our living body. At the most fundamental level, you can say that the only thing that defines a boundary of whatever kind is that there is a change of phase. But that means that if you want to open a boundary, or if you want to close a boundary, that if you want to create a boundary, if you want to destroy a boundary, then you need to invert the phase. If the ball is flying and you're able to have the ball fly backwards, then you have created a boundary at that moment that the ball starts to fly backwards. It means that everything in life can then be reduced to the principle of phase inversion, or in a more general sense, phase change. And then you can see that living organisms are capable to create boundaries in their environment, but not just that. They're able to create boundaries connected to boundaries, connected to boundaries, connected to boundaries. In your body, you can see that there are layers upon layers of boundaries. The first cell has a membrane. Not even regarding all of the many boundaries within the cell. If you just look at the first cell, it has a boundary. When it separates replicates and multiplies, in cell division you get two cells, two boundaries, and as a result, between the two boundaries, new things can happen. The more boundaries, the more things can happen, and that is a general principle which in physics is described in the laser technology. In laser technology, you have a spark, you put a mirror on the one side, you put a mirror on the other side, and suddenly you have got this, the light from that spark bounce up and down in such a way that it becomes coherent. And in the same way, in living organisms, more and more boundaries can be created in such a way that the information flow within them becomes coherent. That then is the story of the essence of science of life, and the principle of freedom of choice. So now we have two ingredients. We have tetrionics, which describes at the quantum level, how quantum change can form everything that is material and move it. On the other hand, we have the science of life, which simply states that the universe and the functioning of the universe is based on boundaries and relationship between boundaries, with a unifying I-God principle to connect it all, also in how it can develop. Now we can bring those two together and can look at the body cells in a different manner, because we now know that the body cells are based on this principle of Tetragonics, and they are operating the principle of freedom of choice of life. So then the question becomes, well, how can cells do that? The answer already is implied in Tetragonics and the science of life. And from the perspective of the science of life, we know that it is a kind of laser principle. It has to do with boundaries and resetting boundaries, creating, eliminating boundaries by changing phase. And in Tetragonics we can see that this is based on the interplay between the quantum field and tetrions, and that actually in that interplay between the quantum field and tetrions there are two kind of dynamic. The one is the linear flow, which can move things forward and backwards. I call it exergy. It can put movement in or take movement out of something. The other dynamic is that of the circular rotation, which can be a circulation around a tetrion, or it can be a circulation between clusters of tetrions. And that is the internal circulation within matter, which is what we normally call energy. In our body, we can then see that these principles come together. We have the quantum field, we have the linear flow, we have the circular flow, and we have the tetrions, matter. In the cells, this is the principle that cells operate by, and in their fundamental activity, one of the fundamental activities that we notice of the cells is that they're able to make molecules and to change molecules. In order to change molecules, you must be able to work with atomic nuclear forces. That means that the cells are able to slice and splice atoms. They are able to work with the strong forces, the weak forces, and the right forces, as a result of which atoms which are connected suddenly prefer not to be connected anymore. From Tetragonics we can see that there are only two principles which the cells can use. One is the linear flow and the other is the circular flow. And so in the linear flow it would be a bit as if they have a cutting knife or a pasting glue by which they can connect or disconnect the atoms. And with the circular flow they can move atoms away from each other or towards each other. Evidently there's a lot more to say about what happens at that level where the cells then are able to work with that quantum field energy as a direct linear flow or as a directed circular flow, and evidently they can change the orientation of that too. We can conclude that because cells are able to put atoms together or take atoms apart in the making and the remaking of the molecules as they do. So simply from knowing that cells produce the body materials, we know that cells are able to produce and transform molecules, but that means by definition that cells are able to work with atomic nuclear forces. But now we need to add the understanding that if they work with atomic nuclear forces, they need to work with an information field which is much larger than that what they are doing at that specific point in time and place, for the simple reason that we know that what cells do in one place connects to what happens in the body somewhere else. That means we have to understand that the body as a whole is a hologram field, and that in that hologram field at light speed all of the processes are connected, that together forms a radio information field, which all of the cells in the body can tap into, which means that all of the cells in the body have that information when they decide to do what they do or not. It does mean that cells are conscious. It does mean that cells operate freedom of choice. It does mean that cells have decisions. It implies that cells also have a will. We can see that cells are able to express, and we can also infer that cells are able to associate and dissociate from the cells in the environment. Most often we see that in diseases. From the science of life, we know that there are four principles of freedom of choice, which is that there is choice, there is a decision, that there is a conviction, and there is an action. We tend to know that there's choice, will, expression, and association or dissociation. And we see that happen at the level of the cells. So this gives us the fundamental understanding of the psychosomatic principle. The psychosomatic principle is where we can know that cells combine and recombine atoms, materials, which is the body part of the story. But in doing that, they make use of information, of their own information, the information of neighboring cells, the information of the body, the information of the environment. So that is where they use intelligence or consciousness in doing what they do. Psyche. It means that the psychosomatic principle is seen exactly and precisely in the cells when they are working with the linear flow and the circular flow of the quantum field. In tetrodotals, those are called the BEMF flow and the CHEM flow. CHEM is the linear flow, the BEM is the circular flow. So the cells work with that in working with matter. This is the core point where we see the psychosomatic principle at work. The cells work with the quantum field flows, the psychic side of it, the information side of the story. And the cells do that in working with materials, tetrions, atoms, molecules, matter, which is the body side of the story. The principle of psychosomatics is then the direct link between information and matter. So we now have a direct way of understanding this. But we can also see in the body how this takes place in the body as a whole. And that we experience as a relationship between the psychology and the physiology. By the work of Bert Vervain, we can simply see that what the cells do internally results in what the cells do collectively. The other side of that story is the work of Hans Selye. Hans Selye describes what happens within the cells. Bert Vervain described what happens between the cells. Between the cells, we can see that the information exchange between the cells has a physical form as well. So the physiology is also the body aspect of it all. And in the body aspect, I have explained that separately already. We can see that the molecules are at the same time physical, chemical, electromagnetic, and photonic. They work with all of these aspects of the electromagnetic field. And we need to realize that we are dealing with an electromagnetic field. That there is a photon and quantum field on the one side. There's the electromagnetic interaction when we're looking at what happens in the atoms. There is the electron flow, which we call the chemistry at the level of physiology. And there's the bound electrons in what we call the anatomy or the structured matter. So that brings together the whole understanding of the psychosomatic system. And in the psychosomatic principle, we also have the basis for understanding how the cells build the body as a whole. That too is implied by the work of Bert Vervain, that the cells how this physical interaction, which is chemical, which is in fact electromagnetic, which is simply a form of information, which means that even though the cells have molecules which are tangibly only local, that nevertheless they have a chemical field around them of electrical affinities, which determines how they will act and interact with each other, which is the chemistry of the story. But those electrical field charges are already in an information field compared to the antenna field around an antenna, which means that these molecules have a much larger field of influence than just defined by the local position or by the local chemical affinities. But there is also that level where the molecules are directly interacting with the photon field, which means that they are actually connected to the quantum field itself, which is immaterial. In the building of the body, the cells use these atomic forces on the basis of this cosmic energy information, and that is the core of the psychosomatic principle. Information matters. There's a lot more to say about all of this, and I've described quite a bit of that in other talks about the physiology and the way the mind and all the processes in the body are interconnected as part of this integral electromagnetic field dynamic that forms our body. But I now simply want to switch this inside out and bring this from the understanding of how the cells build the body to the way that architects can build housing for our bodies. In our body, we can see that the cells are very precise in what they do and how they do it. The architecture of our body is very exactingly precise, and that's because it is not a physical process that we see in action, but an electromagnetic process. We literally see the transmutation of the alchemical elements. Cells very literally use the holographic field to change the radio field within the body, as a result of which they can change the chemistry of the body as a whole, which results in the manifestation or materialization of the body in the form that it gets out of all these previous process levels. When you look what happens in a cell, it works with these linear flows and these circular flows, reorganizes atoms to make molecules. These molecules are put out in the body, but once they are in the body, they either go in the communication circulation of the physiology of the cells, which is also the mind, the psychology, but they are also stuck in place, in forming bones, in forming connective tissues, in forming connections between cells and what we call organs, and also in having spaces between all of those and the communication channels in the body. The way in which this happens is very precise. Just pick up a book of anatomy and get a good one. Get the one with the photographs. Better still, find the work of Walter Schemp, who actually shows the pictures of the details of what happens in the body from MRI imaging. And then you can see the supreme and superb logic of how cells build the body. It was already well known that the bone in the body has this trabeculae shapes, like it's the same shape as the Gothic cathedral, and for exactly the same reason. In the Gothic cathedral, they knew how the lines of force needed to be captured by the materials that were used to uphold the walls of the church. The higher the wall, the more chances that the wind will blow it sideways one way or the other. And somehow you need to be able to have that force which comes sideways go out of the building to the side without blowing over the building. There are some very neat calculations in potential analysis. You can actually see the lines of force that are involved. And in the bones of the body, you can recognize that that's the principle by which these bones are built. As Robert Becker showed, it is the electric field and the shape of the electric field that determines how the cells in the bone, the osteoblast and osteoclast, will build up and break down the calcium in the bone so that it actually reflects these lines of force of the electromagnetic field. As a result of the way the cells make these materials, the body materials have four characteristics. Again, the alchemy at play. At the physical structured level, they are piezoelectric, which means that if you squeeze the materials, electrons will come out, but the other way around. If there is a precise electromagnetic field, it can vibrate the matter of the body. The piezoelectric effect is at the physical level. At the physiological level, we are seeing that interplay between information and matter as the liquid crystal phenomenon. Essentially, it means that the electromagnetic information field interacts with that body in such a way that bound electrons can become circulating electrons and the other way around. By binding, it becomes physical. By releasing that bond, it becomes liquid. The liquid crystal materials in our body are plentiful. Bile was actually the example of the liquid crystal display LCD screen. And it is necessary to understand how many of the body materials operate in that in-between state, between physical and phasical, as I prefer to call it. Third level of that alchemy of transmutation of materials, where the information interacts with matter, is in the principle which is called that of the transistor, or also known as the transducer transponder. That is where the electrical field, the information field, in and around the material can actually determine how the flow of electrons will go within the material, one way or the other way. It can direct how the material is an electrical conductor. And as Bjorn Nordenstrom pointed out, all of our body is electrical. In a larger interpretation, we can say the whole body is an electromagnetic field in four degrees of density, just like the alchemists described. And Bjorn Nordenstrom explains that the electrical flow in the body passes throughout all of the body. And the blood vessels are conductors of electricity, the neurons are conductors of electricity, the hormones are carriers of electricity, connective tissues are deeply connected to that whole information transformation communication in the body. And in that sense, we can better look at the whole body as a motherboard of a computer. And the cells in the body have put that motherboard in place to optimize their own cell communication. At the level of the transistor, we can see that it is at that level that the cells can actually use the information flow in the materials to direct the information flow in the materials. It is very much more interactive, just as what you would see in the interaction between electricity and magnetism at that level. Because evidently the piezoelectric is at the physical level, materials. The liquid crystal is at the chemical level, molecular. Likewise, the transistor effect is atomic. But there's a deeper level still, which in the body materials is called the intelligent gel. And that is the place where there is a kind of interchangeability between the form of matter and the form of the information in the quantum field. it is a kind of direct mirroring between the information and matter, and the matter can actually dissolve, and that's something which is seen in the cell replication process when materials become molecular, become atomic, and then seem to dissolve, but then bounce back. And in the same way, in the intelligent gel, the materials seem to be lost, but with the change of information, they are being reconstituted, they bounce back. So we see all of those four processes taking place in the body as the body is being built. And we also see that those four types of body materials are all used to together create the alchemy, not just of the forming of the body, but more specifically the alchemy of the forming of the electromagnetic fields in the body. And that is where we can then turn the picture around using the principle of Bert Vervain, because where he said that the physiology is the foundation of the anatomy and actually the source of the formation of the body, and then in the body we can see that the information dynamic that is associated with this physiology is what we call the psychology. But that what we see inside our body as physiology and psychology, we see outside of our body as the sociology and the ecology. The sociology in how we relate to each other as humans. The ecology is how we relate to the earth. The same, it's now not about the communication between the cells, but the communication between the people. And it is not about the use of information to work with the materials, but it is about the consciousness of humans in interacting with Earth, the Earth. And that is what the architects do. There's a story in itself of what architects do and can do, but essentially the architects work with two materials. One is the materials of Earth, and the other is the material called humanity or consciousness. So there we see the psychosomatic principle again, but now as the interplay between mind and matter. On the one hand, the mind, the understanding of the architect, of the understanding of the people that the architect works with, and on the other hand, the understanding of the materials and how these materials can be formed and reformed and transformed. The schools of architecture explain how people can use materials, and that's why the schools of architecture are connected to the schools of engineering, because engineering is mainly the understanding of the use of materials for specific purposes. It requires the understanding of the materials, and it requires an understanding of how you can work with materials and what the materials can then become and do. In engineering, the part of engineering which is most connected to living beings and how beings live is architecture. And in that sense, architecture is the best replica of the psychosomatic effect in the body. So architects actually are expressions of the psychosomatic principle. And in that sense, architects need to understand that within our body, the psychosomatic principle is never at the cellular level. It is not that the cell produces materials and then puts them out and hopes that something will come out of it. It's rather the other way around. The cells already know what's going on. The cells know what's happening in the whole of the body, and the cells realize that by making some materials they will change what happens in the body, and they will have to work with the whole sequence of consequences, whatever comes out of that. And it is that understanding of the cell being able to work with the whole sequence of consequences of what comes out of making a new molecule that would be very helpful in a school of architecture. That would be where architects then learn that there is a sequence of consequences to everything that they do. And that is where we can then connect that understanding of architects and architecture to that of meta design. And in a way, we need to also go to an understanding of a meta architecture, where we realize, as I mentioned before, that architecture of buildings needs to be part of landscape architecture. It also needs to be connected directly to interior design architecture. How will people actually be able to touch and handle and interact with these structures? But it also needs to be connected to the architecture of the soul. How will these buildings open up possibilities or limit possibilities in the people that live in those buildings? So that brings me to the close of this story, because the story on meta design is best told in itself. But the conclusion is that architects are actually using the psychosomatic principle. Architects would be much better in what they do if they are able to build with a notion of all the sequences of consequences, and as John Wood called it, design futures. You need to look into the far consequences of the far future, just as the American Indians said that any political decision must be valid for at least 7 generations. So when you take that future into account, and when you take the people into account, you are also aware that different people will be living in that building. The building will be serving different purposes, and that means that the building as a whole must have the larger purpose. The rooms in the building may be catered for more specific purposes, and the furniture and upholstery within the room will be tailored for very specific purposes. So at that level, an architect then needs to understand the upholstery furniture in the room as the direct hands-on how do you experience the building. The architect needs to understand the room and the kind of resonator for specific activities, physical or mental, of the people living in the building. The architect needs to understand how different rooms create a building, and how the building needs to be symphonic, harmonic, how all these functions need to be logically connected, and also be able to interact. And in our body, we can see that different principles are being used than we now see in the buildings and the houses. So there's a lot that architects can still learn from how the body does that. But also at the fourth level, architects need to realize that they also need to be landscape architects. They need to account for what happens in the environment. And not just that by placing a building in a landscape you change the climate, but also that the normal climate will have consequences by having a building standing in that specific area. Think of a skyscraper and the vortex wind churning off at the wake behind that building. So there suddenly is a fragmented flow of wind behind the building, and depending on the direction of the wind, that will be in different places. So that needs to be all taken into account. And in the body, we can see those kind of processes, we can see those kind of principles. And that essentially is the aim of that presentation of bodybuilding. That's also why I use that title of bodybuilding. When architects look into the way the cells build the body, they will see not only the principles by which they themselves combine information and matter by the psychosomatic principle, but they will also have so many examples how in the body over billions of years specific kind of activities can be accommodated for and can be optimized, And in that sense, if architects would look at the different types of cells as, say, upholstery or the hands-on level of experience of life with matter, then they can also understand why and how cells created organs, and that could be a neuron, it could be a single cellular system, it could be an organ, it could be something like bone or connective tissue, and each of them has a story about a specific purpose with a specific duration, but also a very detailed role for all of those other functions. The more the bone can be the bone, the more the muscle can be a muscle. And in city designs, a lot of that kind of understanding is still lacking. And in landscape designs, that seems to be still very much ignored. And that's where I then hope that by a thought as this of bodybuilding, architects can spend a couple of weeks, a couple of months of looking at the body and not only be fascinated at how their body works, but also be fully inspired by the simplicity and effectivity and efficacy by which cells are able to divide and produce the body materials and create that whole setting, as a result of which we can do all kind of things that we would like to do on this environment of Earth.